This is Yarra Valley Yarns, Episode 4, Lest We Forget.
Hello, I'm Matt Shaw, and this is Yarra Valley Yarns, the podcast series about the people and places of the Yarra Valley. Every year, many towns within the Yarra Valley community stop to remember the men and women who gave service to our nation during times of conflict. Of course, it's usually on Anzac Day on April 25 or Remembrance Day on November 11 when we gather at the many memorials throughout the Yarra Valley. And there are many memorials within our community. They take different shapes, sizes and forms. And many have fascinating stories of their own, not only about the people and the events they were established to commemorate, but also how and why the memorials were created, how they have adapted through the years, and for some, how they'll continue to be relevant into the future. Recently, I was lucky to have the opportunity to have a yarn with Anthony McAleer, OAM. Anthony's dedication to local history is extraordinary. He has written more than 20 books, many of which are on the history of the Yarra Valley, biographies of notable local people, and many on our area's military history. In 2018, Anthony was awarded a Medal of the Order of Australia for outstanding community service and for achievements in military history. So when it comes to how we remember our servicemen and women, Anthony knows more than most. He has also been responsible for creating some 60 memorials in our area. I caught up with Anthony at the Mount Evelyn RSL, where we yarned about how we remember members of our community who have served and the importance and the uniqueness of the memorials here in the Yarra Valley.
War memorials are quite a powerful sort of reminder and a powerful tribute. They've evolved a little bit over time. I mean, for example, originally things like honour boards and avenues of honour during World War One were used as a tribute. They've always been a tribute, but were also used as a recruiting tool. So, for example, an honour board would be created by a community group, could be a church or a school or whatever. And the whole idea was, and these were done during the war years, so what they didn't wait until after the war, it was done during the war years. And the whole idea was, you join up, you too can have your name added to this honour roll. If you join up, you too can have a tree planted in this avenue of honour in your name. So they were certainly a lot of those original ones were used as recruiting tools. In fact, if you see an honour board and you know that's looks like it's 100 years old, if it's not in alphabetical order, I can guarantee that was started during the war. If it is in alphabetical order, I can guarantee it was done after the war when they've collected all their names together and able to do that in hindsight. Sort of moving on from there, and just after the First World War finished, that there were certainly a plethora of different war memorials, your cenotaphs, your concrete diggers and such like that. Now, it's important to remember that during World War One and World War Two, is that if a soldier died overseas, they were buried overseas. So they were buried in the Commonwealth war graves. As a result, family members could never really get the chance to go and visit their loved ones' graves overseas. It was certainly the tyranny of distance here in Australia. To get over to Europe, it was 6 to 7 weeks on a ship. So it wasn't something that could easily be done. So as a result, these names placed on war memorials were almost a replacement for their grave, and a lot of families treated it that way. And I think the community also looked upon it that way. And certainly, although that aspect has been forgotten a little bit, it should be remembered because, it gives that added importance, I think, to these objects within our community. So, sort of moving on from there to World War II, the war memorials after that tended to be a little bit different. They were something that a lot of communities didn't sort of, you know, create a new war memorial. Some were updated. But what they tended to do was to gather the money together, instead of building a concrete cenotaph, is to build something that was useful. The best example of that is probably at Seville, where the CWA created a war memorial bus shelter. So that was something the community needed, but you know, so that they could kill two birds with one stone, create a tribute, but also have something that was there that the community could use. And they also did the War Memorial swimming pool. So again, they gathered the money together, created something that would be of value to the community, and at the same time, you know, using it as a way to pay tribute to those from Seville who had served. Vietnam and Korea tended to be forgotten until recent years, if at all. I mean, this area has been quite proactive in regards to recognising veterans from those conflicts. But you know, outside of that, it's fairly rare to see the names of Vietnam or Korean sort of veterans, even those who were fatal casualties over there, to be recognised on the local war memorials. But during 1995, there was a government program called Australia Remembers. There was a lot of funding available during that time. So a lot of communities were able to update or to create memorials for their World War II veterans. So there was a lot of memorials done during there. And then recently, during the centenary of World War I, there was... again, a government program where there was money available, and a lot of communities, either if they didn't have a World War I memorial, were able to create that, or certainly update it with new information. Well, it's certainly happened at like Sylvan, where the Wandon Rotary built a new memorial there, but also the Montrose Memorial, War Memorial. We discovered that there was a list of names on there, but if you go to the official records, there was a lot more names that from Montrose that just weren't recognised. And that could be for a variety of reasons. But certainly, and you know, I'd say lack of communication back in 1919, where you didn't have the internet or access to, you know, records. It was probably relying a lot on oral history and what locals knew. But also, there is a little bit of a frustration recently, you know, sort of 100 years later, that the names on the memorial, and usually it is just an initial, first name, and a surname. Now, that was fine 100 years ago because everyone in that community knew who that was referring to, knew the personal details behind it and their sort of and what happened to them. 100 years later, very few people do know that, and it can have about as much meaning as a phone book, really. So there's been a sense of putting more information into the names that are recognised on these memorials. So, for example, with Montrose, what we have done is done the list of all of those from Montrose who had served in the First World War. We'll have their name, we'll have their rank, we'll have their army number, we'll have the unit they served with, we'll have the years they served with. If they died while on active service, we'll also include the where they died, the date that they died, and the cemetery that they're buried on. And I think the more information that you can put into these memorials, the more people will see those names as a person, as it'll bring a sense of reality to it. And I think once people see that, they have a personal connection, or they can have a personal connection with the name that's on there. And, you know, I mean, certainly with the way things are today, we're encouraging people to go off and do some more research, find out a bit more. There's lots of extra information you can sort of do to bring some of these names to light. So certainly over the past 100 years, the major aspect is to pay tribute to these people, but the meaning and the reasons for them being created has certainly evolved over the years. So what you you see today on the Montrose War Memorial is it was built just after World War One, and there was there's a list of names on there. So it's the initial with the surname, and we have since added the World War II names to it with a plaque. But what we're doing now is using the records that are available today. We've added the extra names, but also the names that are already on it. We've included them in the list and given more information, so that people will be able to get a better understanding and get more information about the people from residents from that township.
Have you got a great local story worth sharing? Find us on Facebook or email yarravalleyyarns@gmail.com.
The cenotaph located at the intersection of Beanak Road and Hunter Road at Wandanyalik is another unique memorial for several reasons.
The little square that it's on is actually owned by the council. You know, we're only talking about metres. That's how small it is. Everything around is private land. You got to remember, back in 1919, when they put the war memorial there, that was almost the centre of the town. You had the school, you had the general store, you had the churches. They were all on that that corner. So that's why the memorial was placed there. However, the general stores disappeared, although the churches and the school is still there. But the main sort of shopping district and area where the sort of most of the residents pass through has gone further up the road to Warburton Highway. So yes, it's in a strange situation where it's on this small little piece of land. Luckily, the owners of the land around have been very accommodating and very happy to allow for services so that they can sort of people can sit and stand and see the service on Anzac Day and Remembrance Day and that. But yeah, it certainly is going to become a bit of a question for that community, the Wandan community. I mean, do they keep it there? There's certainly reasons for not keeping it there. Where do they take it? Do you know, some place where the hopefully where you know a lot more people can see it and sort of and get a sense of the service and sacrifice of Wandan residents. I mean, if you've ever seen it on Anzac Day, where a lot of elderly people trying to get across that road, it is pretty hairy. So. And look, there's a lot of there's a couple of people that say, hey, they put it there, it should stay there. I don't know if that's a valid reason. Things change, things develop. They can't, you know. I can tell you now, back in 1919, when they sort of built that memorial, they had no idea that one day there'd be as many people turning up to their services, and that's in the hundreds, you know, at Wandan. You know, I think if they did, they would have probably, you know, sort of created something a bit more substantial. And, you know, they would have been amazed to think that 100 years later that it's still being recognised, and not only that, that the community has embraced, Anzac Day in the way that it has. I think even the Lilydale War Memorial is in a similar situation, where it's on this small piece of land right on a highway, and every Anzac Day they have to close off the highway. There's been so many issues and problems, whereas not far from there you've got Melba Park, which would accommodate the large numbers, and they've had thousands, you know, sort of turn up to their services. It would certainly accommodate that. Again, there's a lot of people, especially those who have been in the town for a long time, say no, they put it there, so it should stay there. But again, I don't think that's a valid reason. One of the first war memorials in Victoria is at Lilydale, and that is just behind the current Yarra Ranges Regional Museum, and that's the Mafeking Tree. Now, this dates back to 1900. At that time, Australia was involved in a conflict overseas known as the Anglo-Boer War. So from 1899 to 1902, units of Australians were going over and serving in South Africa, and to assist the British forces there against the Boers. So there was conflict sort of happening over there. Now there was a town called Mafeking that was in South Africa, and in the early days of the Boer War, there was the British were decimated. They lost battle after battle. It was, and the casualties were high, and there was really no great news sort of coming out of South Africa. However, the one thing that people had to hold on to was this little township called Mafeking, which was surrounded. It was sieged by the Boers, but they the military and the residents in the town held on. And it was something like over 220 days or something that they held on with no supplies and such. When it was finally relieved by the British forces, there was huge celebrations that happened right around the British Empire. And Lilydale was no different. When the news reached Lilydale, they rang the fire bell, people came out, they celebrated. You know, similar to the stories that you hear of the end of the First World War and the Second World War. And they had a huge march up the street and et cetera, et cetera. One of the things they decided to do to commemorate the event was to plant an oak tree, English oak, of course, and they put a metal guard around it and a little plaque. And on this plaque, it commemorated the relief of Mafeking. And of interest, the commanding officer of that little town of Mafeking was a gentleman by the name of Colonel Robert Baden Powell, who later went on to form the Boy Scout movement. In fact, he used a lot of the young fellows for scouting sort of roles in the township during the siege. It's sort of you know, some people even, you know, point that was the start of the Boy Scout movement, is the Mafeking. So that was quite nice, the fact that you know, sort of for well over, you know, sort of 107 years that the Mafeking tree has been out the back of the museum, and the original plaque has still been on there. However, during COVID, some evil mongrel has come along and stolen the original plaque, which is you know, absolutely a disgrace, but also something that's a great loss, I think, for the community. Because, as I said, this is one of the first war memorials in Victoria, because certainly there was memorials put up after the Boer War finished, but that wasn't until 1902. So this being 1900, it was one of those, the first ones to recognise it. So it is very very sad that that was taken. So in recent times, the council has reproduced the plaque and actually put that plaque onto a rock that's at the base of the Mafeking tree. So the same information is still there, but sadly the original one, I'm hoping, is just sitting in someone's collection somewhere and will see the light of day and come back to the community at some stage. And by the way, if you know any information about it, please contact the Lilydale Police Station ASAP. Another interesting one, there is currently a lot of debate in our society about what constitutes a war to be commemorated, what constitutes a conflict to be commemorated. And certainly here in Australia, we recognise colonial conflicts that Australians were involved in, like, for example, the Sudan in 1885 and the New Zealand Maori Wars in the 1860s, and things like the Boxer Rebellion in China, 1902, and the Anglo-Boer War. And even to a certain extent, we can say that the Battle at Eureka is very well sort of commemorated as well, especially if you go to Ballarat. However, do we sort of commemorate our frontier conflicts? Some of the horrific battles and the horrific casualties that occurred between the First Nation people and the early European settlers. Are they a part of our war history? Are they a part of our military history? Even though it may not have been military people always involved with the conflicts. So, having said that, here in the Shire of Yarra Ranges, we have recognised one conflict that did happen. What was is loosely termed as the Battle of Yering Flat. So this was this occurred, and I think it was late 1830s, early 1840s. I can't remember the exact date. It was a group of armed indigenous people who were roaming the area, and a group of border police who had arrived at the Ryrie property just near the Yarra River in Yering, where today's Yering Station is, basically. There was a conflict that ensued where both groups fired upon each other. Now, luckily, no one was hit. They were either bad shots or their rifles they had weren't that accurate. But shots were fired between the two, to which the first peoples that were involved in it did escape. But it's considered to be the first armed conflict that occurred here in Victoria. So in recent times, there's been a small memorial plaque recognising that fact, and that is out at Yering. Just at the that lovely little walkway where the wetlands are, just near the bridge at the Yarra River. So that's something that's quite unique. There's very few memorials in Victoria that recognise our the frontier conflicts that occurred.
I ask Anthony if, amongst all the memorials he's been involved with and all the stories he's shared through his many books, if there's one story which, for him, stands out amongst them all.
Look, it's very hard to pick one out, but I think one that sort of I think is quite unique is the story of a fellow by the name of J.D. Burns, James Drummond Burns. He was a young fellow who his father was the reverend at the Presbyterian Church in Lilydale, and he lived in Lilydale. He had 1914 when the war started. He just finished high school. He was at Scotch College, and he'd then won a scholarship to go to Ormond College the next year in at Melbourne University. Now, he was the ducks of the school at Scotch College. He was highly thought of by his peers and the teachers. But he was a young man who was quite affected by the war, and being in a place like Scotch College, who were quite enthusiastically supporting the war. He'd seen a lot of the fellas he knew that he'd played footy with and been involved with the debating sort of classes and that go off and enlist in those early battalions. So he finished up at Scotch College, came home, and he was preparing to go to Ormond in the new year. But he came home and he certainly gave the whole thing some serious thought. And as a result, he decided to also enlist in early 1915. So he goes off into the army, and while he was in camp at Broadmeadows, he wrote a poem, and this poem summed up his thoughts about the reasons why he wanted to go and enlist, and it was all about offering support to the mother country, to England. It was called The Bugles of England, and it was about the bugles calling across the oceans to Australia, calling him to come and help.
The bugles of England were blowing o'er the sea, as they had called a thousand years, calling now to me. They woke me from dreaming in the dawning of the day. The bugles of England, and how could I stay? The banners of England, unfurled across the sea, floating out upon the wind, were beckoning to me. Storm-rent and battle-torn, smoke-stained and grey, the banners of England, and how could I stay? O England, I heard the cry of those that died for thee, sounding like an organ voice across the winter sea. They lived and died for England, and gladly went their way. England, O England, how could I stay?
So he then goes off overseas. He arrives in Egypt, and then he's sent to Gallipoli. He was only at Gallipoli a month when he was shot and killed by a sniper in one of the trenches. His funeral at Gallipoli was described by numerous people who were involved, and it was quite emotive. He was very highly thought of. I mean, he was only 19 years old. What he didn't realise at the time was that little poem that he'd written and given to a former teacher, had been sent off to the papers and had been published and had been taken off, around Australia. When people read this, it articulated for them exactly why somebody had gone off and enlisted and the important reasons why. When he was killed in action, he was hailed as the schoolboy poet, and the schoolboy poet who gave his life in a cause, the schoolboy poet who was really a martyr. And as I said, his poem continued throughout the war years. People would quote the poem when they would put the memorial notices in the paper. And there were people had put it to music and created a song. It was probably the best received and most widely known Australian poem, war poem, ever. There's nothing that comes even close to it. And not only that, in the next World War that came, it also took on a new meaning as well, and they were using it again as a way of inspiring people and such. Now, I say this in regards to the James Drummond Byrne story, is the real meaning of this story is a story of potential lost. This was a young man who wrote a poem that was hugely received, so well received. What else could he have done? Could he have been another Henry Lawson? Could he have, gone off and married and had children? Could he have had a child that, came out with a cure for cancer or had done something significant? Could he have been a hugely significant member of his community and influenced, so many people? We lost in that war so many young men like him that could have done extraordinary things for their country.
Thanks for listening to this Yarra Valley Yarn. My thanks to the Seville Community House, Yarra Valley FM 99.1, Joe Cooper, Anthony McAleer, OAM, and the Mount Evelyn RSL. The Bugles of England was read by Liam Jones.
Yarra Valley Yarns is written, produced, and presented by Matt Shaw and proudly supported by the Yarra Rangers Council.